Hey, creepy cats, and welcome back. You guys, we made it to 1.2K. It's unbelievable. I just want to thank you all for your support and listening to the podcast. I generally do appreciate it. I know it's been a hot minute since my last episode, and I'm going to try my best to be more active. The last episode we did here on Stories in the Dark was Amelia Earhart. And y'all seem to really like that one, actually. What do you guys think? I mean, do you think she's alive? Would she be still alive? I mean, I'll see why not. What do you think happened? Always something new, isn't it? All right. I got a new case for y'all. If you hear me clear my throat, sorry. Allergy season sucks. But I have a new case for you. So today we're going to talk about the Lindbergh kidnapping. Okay. So this is a story of Charles Augustus Lindbergh Jr. On March 1st, 1932, Charles Augustus Lindbergh Jr., a 20-month-old son of aviators Charles Lindbergh and Anne Moreau Lindbergh, was abducted from the crib in the upper floor of the Lindbergh's home, Highfields in East Amwell, New Jersey, United States. On May 12th, the child's corpse was discovered by a truck driver by the side of a nearby road. Oh, that's so heartbreaking. Oh. Why? Why is it always children? The children's cases always hit hard. I'm an aunt to two beautiful little girls, and my heart. In September 1934, a German immigrant carpenter named Bruno Richard Hauptmann was arrested for the crime. After a trial that lasted from January 2nd, hey, that's my birthday, to February 13th, 1935, he was found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to death. Despite his conviction, he continued to profess his innocence, but all appeals failed, and he was executed in the electric chair at the New Jersey State Prison on April 3rd, 1936. Here in Canada, we actually do not have the electric chair or death row like the Americans do. In Canada, basically, you're sentenced to life. You spend the rest of life behind bars. In the States, y'all don't fuss around. Yo. Like, good for you guys. Like, I get it. Like, at the same time, I do not condone anyone dying, because I personally think you should live with what you did. Because karma's gonna bite you in the fucking ass. But yeah, we don't have that here in Canada. Newspaper writer H.L. Menchkin called the kidnapping and trial the biggest story since the Restoration. Legal scholars have referred to the trial as one of the trials of the century. The crime spurred Congress to pass the Federal Kidnapping Act, commonly called the Little Lindbergh Law, which made transporting a kidnapped victim across state lines a federal crime. Good. At 7:30 p.m. on March 1, 1932, the Lindbergh nurse, Betty Gow, found that 20-month-old Charles Augustus Lindbergh Jr. was not with his mother, Anne Moreau Lindbergh, who had just come out of the bathtub. Gow then alerted Charles, who immediately went to the child's room, where he found a ransom note containing bad handwriting and grammar in an envelope on the windowsill. Taking a gun, Lindbergh went around the house and the grounds with butler Ollie Waterly. They found impressions in the ground under the window of the baby's room. Pieces of a cleverly designed wood ladder and a baby's blanket. Waterly telephoned the Hopewell Police Department, and Lindbergh contacted his attorney and friend, Henry Breckenridge, and the New Jersey State Police. The ransom note, recreation of the ransom note's signature, with black dots representing punctures in the paper, which is awfully weird. Hopewell Borough Police and New Jersey State Police officers conducted an extensive search of the home and its surrounding area. After midnight, a fingerprint expert examined the ransom note and ladder. No usable fingerprints or footprints were found, leading experts to conclude that the kidnapper or kidnappers wore gloves and had some type of cloth on the soles of their shoes. The fuck? No adult fingerprints were found in the baby's room, including in areas witnesses admitted to touching, such as the window. But the baby's fingerprints were found. The brief handwritten ransom note had many spelling and grammar irregularities. Man, didn't you guys miss me not speaking English properly? This is what it said. Dear sir, have 50,000 ready. Wow. They really didn't speak proper English. 25,000 in 20 bills. 15,000 in 10 bills. And 1 in 5 bills after 2 to 4 days. We will inform you where to deliver the money. We warn you for making any dying public or for notifying the police the child is in gut care. Indication for all letters are signature and 3 holes. They literally had so many spelling mistakes. Boy. Oi. At the bottom of the note were 2 interconnected blue circles surrounding a red circle, with a hole punched through the red circle and 2 more holes to the left and right. Word of the kidnapping spread quickly. Hundreds of people converged on the estate, destroying any footprints evidence. Along with police, well-connected and well-intentioned people arrived at the Lindbergh estate. Military colonels offered their aid, although only one had law enforcement experience. Herbert Norman Schwarzkopf, superintendent of the New Jersey State Police. The other colonels were Henry Skillman Breckenridge, a Wall Street lawyer, and William J. Donovan, a hero of the First World War, who would later head the Office of Strategic Services, OSS, the forerunner of the CIA. Lindbergh and these men speculated that the kidnapping was perpetrated by organized crime figures. They thought that the letter was written by someone who spoke German as his native language. At the time, Charles Lindbergh used his influence to control the direction of the investigation. They contacted Mickey Rosner, a Broadway hanger on rumored to know mobsters. Rosner turned to 2 speakeasy owners, Salvatore Salvi Spital and Irving Bitz, for aid. Lindbergh quickly endorsed the duo and appointed them his intermediaries to deal with the mob. Several organized crime figures, notably Al Capone, Willie Moretti, Joe Adonis, and Abner Zwillerman, spoke from prison, offering to help return the baby in exchange for money or legal favors. Specifically, Capone offered assistance in return for being released from prison under the pretense that his assistance would be more effective. This was quickly denied by authorities. The morning after the kidnapping, authorities noticed President Herbert Hoover of the crime. At that time, kidnapping was classified as a state crime, and the case did not seem to have any grounds for federal involvement. Attorney General William D. Mitchell met with Hoover and announced that the whole machinery of the Department of Justice would be set in motion to cooperate with New Jersey authorities. The Bureau of Investigation, later would be the FBI, was authorized to investigate the case, while the United States Coast Guard, the U.S. Customs Service, and the U.S. Immigration Service, and the Washington, D.C. Police were told that their services might be required. New Jersey officials announced $25,000 reward for the safe return of little Lindy. The Lindbergh family offered an additional $50,000 reward of their own. At this time, the total reward was $75,000, approximately equivalent to $1,172,000 in 2019. Was a tremendous sum of money, because the nation was in the midst of a Great Depression. On March 6th, a new ransom letter arrived by mail at the Lindbergh home. The letter was postmarked March 4th in Brooklyn, and it carried the perforated red and blue marks. The ransom had been raised to $70,000. A third ransom note postmarked from Brooklyn also included the secret marks arrived in Breckinridge's mail. The note told the Lindberghs that John Condon should be the intermediary between the Lindberghs and the kidnappers, and requested notification in a newspaper that the third note had been received. Instructions specified the size of the box the money should come in and warned the family not to contact the police. During this time, John F. Condon, a well-known Bronx personality and retired school teacher, offered $1,000 if the kidnapper would turn the child over to a Catholic priest. Condon received a letter reportedly written by the kidnappers. It authorized Condon to be their intermediary with Lindbergh. Lindbergh accepted the letter as genuine. Following the kidnappers' latest instructions, Condon placed a classified in the New York American reading. Money is ready, Jeffasi. Condon then waited for further instructions from the culprits. A meeting between Jeffasi and a representative of the group that claimed to be the kidnappers was eventually scheduled for late one evening at Woodlawn Cemetery in the Bronx. According to Condon, the man surrounded foreign but stayed in the shadows during the conversation, and Condon was thus unable to get a close look at his face. The man said his name was John, and he related his story. He was a Scandinavian sailor, part of a gang of three men and two women. The baby was being held on a boat, unharmed, but would be returned only for ransom. When Condon expressed doubt that John actually had the baby, he promised some proof the kidnapper would soon return the baby's sleeping suit. The stranger asked Condon, "Would I burn if the package were dead?" When questioned further, he assured Condon that the baby was alive. On March 16th, Condon received a toddler's sleeping suit by mail and a seventh ransom note. After Lindbergh identified the sleeping suit, Condon placed a new ad in the home news. Money is ready, no cops, no secret service, I come alone like last time. On April 1st, Condon received a letter saying it was time for the ransom to be delivered. The ransom was packaged in a wooden box that was custom made in the hope that it would later be identified. The ransom money included a number of gold certificates, since gold certificates were about to be withdrawn from circulation. It was hoped greater attention would be drawn to anyone spending them. The bills were not marked, but their serial numbers were recorded. Some sources credit this idea to Frank J. Wilson, others to Elmer Lincoln Irie. On April 2nd, Condon was given a note by the intermediary, an unknown cab driver. Condon met John and told him that they had been able to raise only $50,000. For the man accepted the money and gave Condon a note saying that the child was in the care of two innocent women. On May 12th, delivery truck driver Orville Wilson and his assistant William Allen pulled to the side of the road about 4.5 miles south of the Lindbergh home near the hamlet of Mount Rose in neighboring Hopewell Township. When Allen went into a grove of trees to urinate, he discovered the body of a toddler. The skull was badly fractured and the body decomposed. After being chewed on by animals, there were indications of an attempt at a hasty burial. Gao identified the baby as the missing infant from the overlapping toes of the right foot and a shirt that she had made. It appeared the child had been killed by a blow to the head. Lindbergh insisted on cremation. That's heartbreaking. In June 1932, officials began to suspect that the crime had been perpetrated by someone the Lindberghs knew. Suspicion fell upon Violet Sharp, a British household servant at the Marrow home who had given contradictory information regarding her whereabouts on the night of the kidnapping. It was also reported that she appeared nervous and suspicious when questioned. She committed suicide on June 10, 1932, by ingesting a silver polish that contained cyanide just before being questioned for the fourth time. Her alibi was later confirmed, and police were criticized for heavy-handedness. Condon was also questioned by police, and his home searched, but nothing suggestive was found. Charles Lindbergh stood by Condon during this time. After the discovery of the body, Condon remained unofficially involved in the case. To the public, he had become a suspect and in some circles was vilified. For the next 2 years, he visited police departments and pledged to find Cemetery John. Condon's actions regarding the case were increasingly flamboyant. On one occasion, while riding a city bus, Condon claimed that he saw a suspect on the street and, announcing his secret identity, ordered the bus to stop. The startled driver complied and Condon darted from the bus. Although his target elude him, Condon's actions were also criticized as explosive when he agreed to appear in a vaudeville act regarding the kidnapping. Liberty magazine published a serialized account of Condon's involvement in the Lindbergh kidnapping under the title Jeffsy Tells All. The investigators who were working on the case were soon at a standstill. There were no developments and little evidence of any sort, so police turned their attention to tracking the ransom payments. A pamphlet was prepared with the serial numbers on the ransom bills, and 250,000 copies were distributed to businesses, mainly in New York City. A few of the ransom bills appeared in scattered locations, some as far as Chicago and Minneapolis, but those spending the bills were never found. By a presidential order, all gold certificates were to be exchanged for other bills by May 1st, 1933. A few days before the deadline, a man brought 2,980 to a Manhattan Bank of Exchange. It was later realized the bills were from the ransom. He had given his name as J.J. Faulkner of 537 West 149th Street. No one named Faulkner lived at that address, and a Jane Faulkner, who had lived there 20 years earlier, denied involvement. During a 30-month period, a number of the ransom bills were spent throughout New York City. Detectives realized that many of the bills were being spent along the route of Lexington Avenue subway, which connected the Bronx with the east side of Manhattan, including German-Austrian neighborhood of Yorkville. On September 18th, 1934, a Manhattan bank teller noticed a gold certificate from the ransom. A New York license plate number, penciled in the bill margin, allowed it to be traced to a nearby gas station. The station manager had written down the license plate number because his customer was acting suspicious and was possibly a counterfeiter. The license plate belonged to a sedan owner by the name of Richard Hauptmann of 1279 East Street in the Bronx, an immigrant with a criminal record in Germany. When Hauptmann was arrested, he was carrying a single $20 gold certificate, and over $14,000 of the ransom money was found in his garage. Hauptmann was arrested, interrogated, and beaten at least once throughout the following day and night. Hauptmann stated that the money and other items had been left with him by his friend and former business partner, Isidore Fish. Fish had died on March 29, 1934, shortly after returning to Germany. Hauptmann stated he learned only after Fish's death that the shoebox that was left with him contained a considerable sum of money. He kept the money because he claimed that it was owed to him from a business deal that he and Fish had made. Hauptmann consistently denied any connection to the crime or knowledge that the money in his house was from the ransom. When the police searched Hauptmann's home, they found a considerable amount of additional evidence that linked him to the crime. One item was a notebook that contained a sketch of the construction of a ladder similar to that which was found at the Lindbergh home in March 1932. John Condon's telephone number, along with his address, were discovered written on a closet wall in the house. A key piece of evidence, a section of wood, was discovered in the attic of the home. After being examined by an expert, it was determined to be an exact match to the wood used in the construction of the ladder found at the crime scene. Hauptmann was indicted in the Bronx on September 24, 1934, for extorting the $50,000 ransom from Charles Lindbergh. 2 weeks later, on October 8th, Hauptmann was indicted in New Jersey for the murder of Charles Augustus Lindbergh Jr. 2 days later, he was surrendered to New Jersey authorities by New York Governor Herbert H. Lehman to face charges directly related to the kidnapping and the murder of the child. Hauptmann was moved to the Hunterdon County Jail in Flemington, New York on October 19th. Hauptmann was charged with capital murder. The trial was held at the Hunterdon County Courthouse in Flemington, New Jersey, and was soon dubbed the trial of the century. Reporters swarmed the town, and every hotel room was booked. Judge Thomas Whitaker Trenchard presided over the trial. In exchange for rights to publish Hauptmann's story in the newspaper, Edward J. Reilly was hired by the New York Daily Mirror to serve as Hauptmann's attorney. David T. Wiltness, Attorney General of New York, Jersey, led the prosecution. Evidence against Hauptmann included $20,000 of the ransom money found in his garage and testimony alleging that his handwriting and spelling were similar to those of the ransom notes. Eight handwriting experts, including Albert S. Osborne, pointed out similarities between the ransom notes and Hauptmann's writing specimens. The defense called an expert to reboot this evidence. While two others declined to testify, the latter two demanded $500 before looking at the notes and were dismissed when Lloyd Fisher, a member of Hauptmann's legal team, declined. Other experts retained by the defense were never called to testify. On the basis of work of Arthur Kohler at the Forest Products Laboratory, the state introduced photographs demonstrating that part of the wood from the ladder matched a plank from the floor of Hotman's attic, the type of wood, the direction of tree growth, the milling pattern, the inside and outside surface of the wood, and the grain of both sides were identical. And four oddly placed nail holes lined up with the nail holes and joints in Hotman's attic. Condon's address and telephone number were written in pencil on a closet door in Hotman's home, and Hotman told police that he had written Condon's address. I must have read it in the paper about this story. I was just a little bit interested and keep a little bit of record. And maybe I was just on the closet and was reading the paper and put it down the address. I can't give you any explanation about the phone number. A sketch that Wilnitz suggested represented a ladder was found in one of Hotman's notebook. Hotman said his picture and other sketches therein were the work of a child. Despite not having any obvious source of earned income, Hotman had bought a $400 radio, approximately equivalent to $7,640 in 2019, and sent his wife on a trip to Germany. Hotman was identified as the man to whom the ransom money was delivered. Other witnesses testified that it was Hotman who had spent some of the Lindbergh gold certificates, that he had been seen in the area of the estate in East Amwell, New Jersey, near Hopewell, on the day of the kidnapping, and that he had been absent from work on the day of the ransom payment and quit his job 2 days later. Hotman never sought another job afterward, yet continued to live comfortably. While the prosecution rested in case, the defense opened with a lengthy examination of Hotman. In his testimony, Hotman denied being guilty, insisting that the box of gold certificates had been left in his garage by a friend, Isidore Fisch, who returned to Germany in December 1933 and died there in March 1934. Hotman said that he had one day found a shoebox left by Fisch, which Hotman had stored on the top shelf of his kitchen broom closet, later discovering the money, which he later found to be almost $40,000. Hotman said that because Fisch had owed him about $7,500 in business funds, Hotman had kept the money for himself and had lived on it since January of 1934. The defense called Hotman's wife, Anna, to corroborate the Fisch story. On cross-examination, she admitted that while she hung her apron every day on a hook higher than the top shelf, she could not remember seeing any shoebox there. Later, rebuttal, witnesses testified that Fisch could not have been at the crime scene and that he had no money for medical treatment when he died of tuberculosis. Fish's landlady testified that he could barely afford the $3.50 weekly rent of his room. In his closing summation, Riley argued that the evidence against Hotman was entirely circumstantial because no reliable witnesses had placed Hotman at the scene of the crime, nor were his fingerprints found on the ladder, on the ransom notes, or anywhere in the nursery. Hotman was convicted and immediately sentenced to death. His attorneys appealed to the New Jersey Court of Errors and Appeals, which at the time was the state's highest court. The appeal was argued on June 29, 1935. New Jersey Governor Harl J. Hoffman secretly visited Hotman in his cell on the evening of October 16th, accompanied by a stenographer who spoke German fluently. Hoffman urged members of the court and heirs and appeals to visit Hotman. In late January 1936, while declaring that he had held no position on the guilt or innocence of Hotman, Hoffman cited evidence that the crime was not a one-person job and directed Schwarzkopf to continue a thorough and impartial investigation in an effort to bring all the parties involved to justice. It became known among the press that on March 27th, Hoffman was considering a second reprise of Hauptmann's death sentence and was seeking opinions about whether the governor had the right to issue a second reprieve. On March 30, 1936, Hauptmann's second and final appeal asking for clemency from the New Jersey Board of Pardons was denied. Hauptmann later announced that this decision would be the final legal action in the case and that he would not grant another reprieve. Nonetheless, there was a postponement when the Mercer County Grand Jury investigating the confession of an artist of Trenton attorney Paul Wendell requested a delay from Warden Mark Kimberling. This, the final stay, ended with the Mercer County prosecutor informing Kimberling that the grand jury had adjourned after voting to end its investigation without charging Wendell. Hauptmann turned down a large offer from a Heerset newspaper for confession and refused a last-minute offer to communicate his sentence from the death penalty to life without parole in exchange for a confession. He was electrocuted on April 3, 1936. After his death, some reporters and independent investigators came up with numerous questions about the way in which the investigation had been run and the fairness of the trial, including witnesses tampering and planting evidence. Twice in the 1980s, Anna Hauptmann sued the state of New Jersey for the unjust execution of her husband. The suits were dismissed on unknown grounds. She continued fighting to clear his name until her death at age 95 in 1994. A number of books have asserted Hauptmann's innocence, generally highlighting inadequate police work at the crime scene. Lindbergh's interference in the investigation, ineffectiveness of Hauptmann's counsel, and weakness in the witnesses and physical evidence. Ludovic Kennedy, in particular, questioned much of this evidence, such as the origin of the ladder and the testimony of many of the witnesses. According to author Lloyd Gardner, a fingerprint expert, Dr. Erastus Mead Hudson applied the then-rare silver nitrate fingerprint process to the ladder and did not find Hauptmann's fingerprints, even in the places that the maker of the ladder must have touched. According to Gardner, officials refused to consider this expert's findings, and the ladder was then washed of all fingerprints. Jim Fisher, a former FBI agent and professor of Edinburgh University of Pennsylvania, has written two books, The Lindbergh Case, 1987, and The Ghosts of Hopewell, 1999. Addressing what he calls a revision movement regarding the case, he summarizes, "Today, the Lindbergh phenomena is a great hoax perpetrated by people who are taking advantage of an uninformed and cynical public. Notwithstanding all of the books, TV programs, and legal suits, Hauptmann is as guilty today as he was in 1932 when he killed the son of Mr. and Mrs. Charles Lindbergh." Another book, Hauptmann's Ladder, a step-by-step analysis of the Lindbergh kidnapping by Richard T. Calhill, Jr., concludes that Hauptmann was guilty but questions whether he should have been executed. According to John Risner, the master detective, New Jersey detective Ellis Parker conducted an independent investigation in 1936 and obtained a signed confession from former Trenton attorney Paul Wendell, creating a sensation and resulting in a temporary stay of execution for Hauptmann. The case against Wendell collapsed, however, when he insisted his confession had been coerced. Several people have suggested that Charles Lindbergh was responsible for the kidnapping. In 2010, Jim Baum's Beneath the Winter Sycamores implied that the baby was physically disabled, and Lindbergh arranged the kidnapping as a way of secretly moving the baby to be raised in Germany. Another theory is Lindbergh accidentally killed his son in a prank gone wrong. In Crime of the Century, the Lindbergh kidnapping hoax criminal defense attorney Gregory Elgren persists Lindbergh climbed a ladder and brought his son out of a window, but dropped the child, killing him, so hid the body in the woods, then covered up the crime by blaming Hauptmann. Robert Zorn's 2012 book, Cemetery John, proposes that Hauptmann was part of a conspiracy with two other German-born men, John and Walter Knoll. Zorn's father, economist Eugene Zorn, believed that as a teenager, he had witnessed the conspiracy being discussed. And that is the case of 20-month-old Charles Augustus Lindbergh Jr.